Chapter 5. The burnished wisp of cold gray slid silently in front of Ted Bentley. Its doors rolled back, and a slim shape stepped out into the chill night darkness.
"Who is it?"
Bentley demanded. The wind lashed through the moist foliage growing against the Davis house. The sky was frigid. Far-off sounds of activity echoed hollowly, the Farben Hill factories booming dully in the darkness.
"Where in God's name have you been?"
A girl's clipped, anxious contralto came to him.
"Varick sent for you an hour ago."
"I was right here," Bentley answered.
Eleanor Stevens emerged quickly from the shadows.
"You should have stayed in touch when the ship landed. He's angry."
She glanced nervously around.
"Where's Davis? Inside?"
"Of course." Anger rose inside Bentley.
"What's this all about?"
"Don't get excited."
The girl's voice was as taut as the frozen stars shining overhead.
"Go back inside and get Davis and his wife. I'll wait for you in the car."
Al Davis gaped at him in amazement as Bentley pushed open the front door and entered the warm, yellow-bright living room.
"He wants us," Bentley said. "Tell Laura. He wants her along, too."
Laura was sitting on the edge of the bed, unstrapping her sandals. She quickly smoothed her slacks down over her ankles as Al entered the bedroom.
"Come on, honey," Al said to his wife.
"Is something wrong?"
Laura leaped quickly up.
"What is it?"
The three of them moved out into the chill night darkness in greatcoats and heavy work boots. Eleanor started up the motor of the car, and it purred forward restlessly.
"In you go,"
Al murmured as he helped Laura find a seat in the inky gloom.
"How about a light?"
"You don't need a light to sit down," Eleanor answered.
She rolled the door shut. The car glided out onto the road and instantly gained speed. Dark houses and trees flashed past. Abruptly, with a sickening whoosh, the car lifted up above the pavement. It skimmed briefly, then arched high over a row of tension lines. A few minutes later, it was gaining altitude over the vast, sprawling mass of buildings and streets that made up the parasitic clusters around the Farben Hill.
"What's this all about?"
Bentley demanded. The car shuddered as magnetic grapple beams caught it and lowered it toward the winking buildings below.
"We have a right to know something."
"We're going to have a little party," Eleanor said with a smile that barely moved her thin crimson lips.
She allowed the car to settle into a concave lock and come finally to rest against a magnetic disc. With a quick snap, she cut the power and threw open the doors.
"Get out. We're here."
Their heels clattered in the deserted corridor as Eleanor led them rapidly from one level to the next. A few silent uniformed guards stood at regular intervals, their pudding faces sleepy and impassive, bulging rifles gripped loosely. Eleanor waved open a double-sealed door and nodded them briskly inside. A billow of fragrant air lapped around them as they pushed uncertainly past her inside the chamber. Reese Varick stood with his back to them. He was fumbling angrily with something, massive arms moving in a slow grind of rage.
"How the hell do you work this damn thing?"
he bellowed irritably. The protesting shrill of torn metal grated briefly.
"Christ, I think I broke it."
"Here," Herb Moore said, emerging from a deep low chair in the corner. "You have no manual dexterity."
"You bet,"
Varick growled. He turned. A huge, hunched-over bear, his shaggy brows protruding bone-hard, thick and belligerent. His blazing eyes bored at the three newcomers as they stood uneasily together. Eleanor Stevens unzipped her greatcoat and tossed it over the back of a luxurious couch.
"Here they are," she said to Varick.
They were all together, enjoying themselves. She stalked over, long-legged in her velvet slacks and leather sandals, and stood before the fire warming her breasts and shoulders. In the flickering firelight, her naked flesh glowed a deep, luminous red. Varick turned without ceremony to Bentley.
"Always be where I can find you."
He bit his words out contemptuously.
"I don't have any more teeps around to thought-wave people in. I have to find them the hard way."
He jerked his thumb at Eleanor.
"She came along, but minus ability."
Eleanor smiled bleakly and said nothing. Varick spun around and shouted at Moore.
"Is that damn thing fixed or not?"
"It's almost ready."
Varick grunted sourly.
This is a sort of celebration, he said to Bentley, although I don't know what we've got to celebrate.
Moore strolled over, confident and full of talk, a sleek little model of an Interplan rocket in his hands. We've got plenty to celebrate. This is the first time a Quizmaster chose an assassin. Peleg isn't somebody chosen by a bunch of senile old fogies. Varric has had him on tap, and this whole thing worked out since...
You talk too much, Varric cut in. You're too damn full of easy words. Half of them don't mean a thing.
Moore laughed gaily. That's what the Corps found out. Bentley moved uncomfortably away. Varric was slightly drunk. He was as menacing and ominous as a bear let out of its cage. But behind his clumsy movements was a slick-edged mind that missed nothing. The chamber was high-ceilinged, done in ancient wood panels, probably from some ancient monastery. The whole structure was much like a church, domed and ribbed, its upper limits dissolving in amber gloom, thick beams charred and hard-smoked from countless fires roaring in the stone fireplace below. Everything was massive and heavy. There were rich, deep colors. The stones themselves were rubbed black with ingrained ash, the upright supports as thick as tree logs. Bentley touched a dully gleaming panel. The wood was corroded but strangely smooth, as if a layer of cloudy light had settled over it and worked its way into the material.
This wood, Varric said, noticing Bentley, is from a medieval body house.
Laura was examining stone-weighted tapestries that hung dead and heavy over the lead-sealed windows. On a mantel over the huge fireplace were battered, dented cups. Bentley gingerly took one down. It was a ponderous lump in his hands, an ancient, thick-rimmed cup, heavy and simple and oblique, medieval Saxon.
"You'll meet Peleg in a few minutes," Varric said to them. "Eleanor and Moore have already met him."
Moore laughed again, his offensive sharp bark, like a thin-toothed dog.
"I've met him all right," he said.
"He's cute," Eleanor said tonelessly.
"Peleg is circulating around," Varric continued. "Talk to him, stay with him. I want everybody to see him. I only plan to send out one assassin."
He waved his hand impatiently.
"There's no point in sending out an endless stream."
Eleanor glanced at him sharply.
"Let's lay it on the line and get it over with."
Varric strode to the closed double doors at the end of the room and waved them open. Sound, rolling volumes of light in the flickering movement of many people, billowed out.
"Get in there," Varric ordered. "I'll locate Peleg."
"A drink, sir or madam?" Eleanor Stevens accepted a glass from the tray passed by a blank-faced Macmillan robot.
"What about you?" she said to Bentley.
She nodded the robot back and took a second glass.
"Try it. It's smooth stuff. It's some kind of berry that grows on the sunward side of Callisto in the cracks of a certain kind of shale 1 month out of the year. Varric has a special work camp to collect it."
Bentley took the glass.
"Thanks.
And cheer up.
What's this all about?"
Bentley indicated the packed cavern of murmuring, laughing people. They were all well-dressed, in a variety of color combinations. Every top-level class was represented.
"I expect to hear music and see them start dancing. There was dinner and dancing earlier. Good grief, it's almost 2 a.m. A lot has happened today. The Twitch, the Challenge Convention, all the excitement."
Eleanor moved off, eyes intent on something.
"Here they come."
A sudden rustle of nervous silence swept over the nearby people. Bentley turned, and so did everyone else. They were all watching nervously, avidly, as Rhys Varric approached. With him was another man. The latter was a slender man in an ordinary gray-green suit, his arms loose at his sides, his face blank and expressionless. A taut ripple of sound swirled after him. There were hushed exclamations and a burst of appreciative tribute.
"That's him,"
Eleanor grated between her white teeth, eyes flashing. She grabbed fiercely at Bentley's arm.
"That's Peleg. Look at him."
Peleg said nothing. His hair was straw yellow, moist and limply combed. His features were uncertain, almost nondescript. He was a colorless, silent person almost lost from sight as the rolling giant beside him propelled him among the alertly watching couples. After a moment, the two of them were swallowed up by satin slacks and floor-length gowns, and the buzz of animated conversation around Bentley resumed.
"They'll be over here later," Eleanor said. She shivered. "He gives me the creeps."
"Well?" She smiled up quickly at Bentley, still holding on tight to his arm.
"What do you think of him?"
"I didn't get any impression."
Off in the distance, Varric was surrounded by a group of people. Herb Moore's enthusiastic voice lifted above the uniform blur of sound. He was expounding again. Annoyed, Bentley pulled a few steps away.
"Where are you going?"
Eleanor asked.
"Home."
The word slipped out involuntarily.
"Where do you mean?"
Eleanor smiled wryly.
"I can't teep you anymore, darling. I gave all that up."
She lifted her flaming crimson hair to show the two dead circles above her ears, lead-gray spots that marred the smooth whiteness of her skin.
"I can't understand you," Bentley said. "An ability you were born with? A unique gift?" "You sound like Wakeman. If I had stayed with the Corps, I would have had to use my ability against Rhys. So what else could I do but leave?"
There was tight agony in her eyes.
"You know, it's really gone. It's like being blinded. I screamed and cried a long time afterward. I couldn't face it. I broke down completely."
"How are you now?" She gestured shakily.
"I'll live. Anyhow, I can't get it back. So, forget it, darling. Drink your drink and relax."
She clinked glasses with him. "It's called methane gale. I suppose Callisto has a methane atmosphere."
"Have you ever been to one of the colony planets?"
Bentley asked. He sipped at the amber liquid. It was strong stuff.
"Have you ever seen one of the work camps, or one of the squatters' colonies after a police patrol has finished with it?"
"No," Eleanor said simply. "I've never been off Earth. I was born in San Francisco 19 years ago. All telepaths come from there, remember? During the final war, the big research installations at Livermore were hit by a Soviet missile. Those who survived were badly bathed. We're all descendants of one family, Earl and Verna Phillips. The whole Corps is related. I was trained for it all the time I was growing up. My destiny."
A vague blur of music had started up at one end of the chamber. A music robot, creating random combinations of sound, harmonic colors and shades that flitted agilely, too subtle to pin down. Some couples started dancing listlessly. A group of men had gathered together and were arguing in loud, angry tones, snatches of words carried to Bentley.
"Out of the lab in June, they say. Would you make a cat wear trousers? It's inhuman. Plow into something at that velocity. Personally, I'll stick to plain old sub-C."
Near the double doors, a few people were seeking out their wraps and wandering away, dull-faced, vacant-eyed, mouths slack with fatigue and boredom.
"It gets like this," Eleanor said.
"The women wander off to the powder room. The men start arguing some point."
"What does Varric do?"
"You're hearing it now."
Varric's deep tones rolled out over everybody else's. He was dominating the argument. People nearby gradually stopped talking and began filtering over to listen. A tight knot of men formed, grim-faced and serious, as Varric and Moore waved louder and hotter.
"Our problems are of our own making," Varric asserted. "They're not real, like problems of supply and labor surplus."
"How do you figure?" Moore demanded.
"This whole system is artificial. This M-game was invented by a couple of mathematicians during the early phase of the Second World War."
"You mean discovered. They saw that social situations are analogs of strategy games, like poker. A system that works in a poker game will work in a social situation, like business or war."
"What's the difference between a game of chance and a strategy game?"
Laura Davis asked, from where she and Al stood. Annoyed, Moore answered,
"Everything! In a game of chance,
No conscious deception is involved. In a poker game, every player has a deliberate strategy of bluff, false leads, putting out misleading verbal reports, and visual horseplay to confuse the other players as to his real position and intentions. He has a pattern of misrepresentation by which he traps them into acting foolishly.
You mean, like saying he has a good hand when he hasn't?
Moore ignored her and turned back to Varric.
You want to deny society operates like a strategy game? Minimax was a brilliant hypothesis. It gave us a rational scientific method to crack any strategy and transform the strategy game into a chance game where the regular statistical methods of the exact sciences function.
All the same, Varric rumbled. This damn bottle throws a man out for no reason and elevates an ass, a crackpot, picked at random, without regard to his ability or class.
Sure, Moore exclaimed, wildly excited. Our whole system is built on Minimax. The bottle forces everybody to play a Minimax game or be squashed. We're forced to give up deception and adopt a rational procedure.
There's nothing rational in this random twitching, Varric answered angrily. How can random machinery be rational?
The random factor is a function of an overall rational pattern. In the face of random twitches, no one can have a strategy. It forces everybody to adopt a randomized method, best analysis of the statistical possibilities of certain events, plus the pessimistic assumption that any plans will be found out in advance. Assuming you're found out in advance frees you of the danger of being discovered. If you act randomly, your opponent can find out nothing about you, because even you don't know what you're going to do.
So we're all a bunch of superstitious fools, Varric complained. Everybody's trying to read signs and harbingers. Everybody's trying to explain two-headed calves and flocks of white crows. We're all dependent on random chance. We're losing control because we can't plan.
How can you plan with teeps around? Teeps perfectly fulfill the pessimistic expectations of Minimax. They find out every strategy. They discover you as soon as you begin playing.
Varric pointed to his great barrel chest.
There are no sissy-kissing charms hanging around my neck. No rose petals and ox dung and boiled owl spit. I play a game of skill, not chance, and maybe not strategy when you pin me down. I never did go by a lot of theoretical abstractions. I go by rule of thumb. He displayed his thumb. I do what each situation demands. That's skill. I've got it.
Skill is a function of chance. It's an intuitive best use of chance situations. You're so goddamn old, you've been in enough situations to know in advance the pragmatic...
What about Pellig? That's strategy, isn't it?
Strategy involves deception, and with Pellig, nobody is going to be deceived.
Absurd, Varric growled. You've been knocking yourself out keeping the Corps from knowing about Pellig.
That was your idea! Moore flushed angrily. I said then, and I say now, let them all know because there's nothing they can do. If I had my way, I'd announce it over TV tomorrow.
You goddamn fool, Varric rasped. You certainly would.
Pellig is unbeatable.
Moore was furious at being humiliated in front of everybody.
We've combined the essence of Minimax. Taking the bottle twitch as my starting point, I've evolved a...
Shut up, Moore, Varric muttered, turning his back. You talk too much.
He moved a few steps away. People hurriedly stepped aside from him.
This random stuff has got to go. You can't plan anything with it hanging over your head.
That's why we have it! Moore shouted after him.
Then drop it. Get rid of it.
Minimax isn't something you turn on and off. It's like gravity. It's a law, a pragmatic law.
Bentley had moved over to listen. You believe in natural law? He demanded. An 8-8, like you?
Who's this fellow?
Moore snarled, glaring furiously at Bentley.
What's the idea of butting into our conversation?
Varric swelled another foot taller.
This is Ted Bentley, class 8-8. Same as you. We just now took him on.
Moore blanched.
8-8? We don't need any more 8-8s.
His face glowed an ugly yellow.
Bentley? You're someone Wazoo Lear tossed out, a derelict.
That's right, Bentley said evenly. And I came directly here.
Why?
I'm interested in what you're doing.
What I'm doing is none of your business.
All right, Varick said hoarsely to Moore. Shut up or get out of here. Bentley's working with you from now on, whether you like it or not.
Nobody gets into the project but me.
Hatred, fear, and professional jealousy blazed on Moore's face.
If he can't hang on at a third-rate hill like Wazoo Lear, he isn't good enough to...
We'll see, Bentley said coolly. I'm itching to get my hands on your notes and papers. I'll enjoy going over your work. It sounds like just what I want.
I want a drink, Varick muttered. I've got too much to do to stand here talking.
Moore shot Bentley a last glance of resentment and then hurried off after Varick. Their voices trailed off as a door was slammed. The crowd of people shifted and began to murmur wearily and break apart. With a shade of bitterness, Eleanor said,
Well, there goes our host. Quite a party, wasn't it?